I'm going to introduce Jackie Cabasso, who's going to speak first, and I think rightly so, because she's going to speak about one of the chief weapons of terror, the nuclear weapons. And Jackie Cabasso, as I trust many of you know her, is probably the founder of the Western States Legal Foundation, which is one of the most thoughtful and best of the many organizations working against nuclear weapons. And Jackie has just come from organizing Hiroshima Nagasaki Week across the country. I mean, individual communities organize, of course, but in coordinating, doing the publicity, and particularly those that were highlighting the role of Bechtel. I'm sure she'll tell you about this, but Bechtel has become, strangely enough, this builder of pipelines and sewage systems, the largest corporation involved in the whole nuclear weapons, nuclear power, nuclear waste industry. So you have a real expert here. I've heard her speak at the UN several times to the gathered delegates. So Jackie Cabasso.
Thank you, Carol. I also want to thank Veterans for Peace for inviting me, and I want to tell you that I'm lucky enough to serve on the National Steering Committee of United for Peace and Justice, the largest anti-war coalition in the country, with your own wonderful executive director, Michael McPherson, who invited me to be here today. So it's a great honor. I'm just going to start off with something to set the context very broadly. While I was preparing things this morning, I came across a very interesting, sobering fact. According to the U.S. Navy's Naval Historical Center records, the U.S. has sent soldiers to intervene in foreign countries more than 240 times in its 230-year history. As of 2006, there are 192 member states in the U.N., and over the past 200 years, the U.S. has attacked, invaded, policed, overthrown, or occupied 62 of them. So I think I want to be clear that I am talking about nuclear weapons in the context of U.S. empire. Now, the title of this workshop is Eliminating Weapons of Terror from U.S. Foreign Policy. What I'm going to talk about is the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. foreign and military policy and how the abolition of nuclear weapons must be part of any strategy for moving beyond war, which is the purpose of this conference overall. And I'm going to talk about two broad themes which are interrelated. One is the historical continuity of U.S. nuclear weapons programs and policies from the Manhattan Project to the present. And the other is the urgent need to bring nuclear disarmament home to the peace and justice movement. Indeed, I think it can be argued that nuclear weapons have become the number one justification for wars by the United States and possibly by Israel. There's a strong relationship between nuclear weapons and conventional force structures. And I think that actually it can be argued that abolishing nuclear weapons is an essential and inseparable element of ending and abolishing wars. So I think it's appropriate to start with remembering that just this past week we commemorated the 61st anniversaries of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in terms of a little action item, I want to ask everybody here to do one thing. It won't take you any time or cost you any money, but it may change history. And that is, whenever you mention Hiroshima or Nagasaki, always say the U.S. atomic bombings. So many times in media reports and even in activist publications and speeches, these horrendous events are referred to as the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 61 years ago, atomic bombs fell on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I heard that so many times last week. And as long as those bombs remain anonymous and unattributed, we're never going to get to the point where we can take responsibility for them and lead the world out of the nuclear age. So the mayor of Hiroshima in 1995 told the International Court of Justice, quote, "History is written by the victors. Thus, the heinous massacre that was Hiroshima has been handed down to us as a perfectly justified act of war. As a result, for 50 years, we have never directly confronted the full implications of this horrifying act for the future of the human race. Hence, we are still forced to live under the enormous threat of nuclear weapons. And I just recently learned that Buckminster Fuller called August 6, 1945, the day the world began taking its final exam. So, as we remember the 61st anniversaries of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the 200,000 mostly civilians who were incinerated or dead by the end of 1945 as a result, the horrifying conflagrations in the Middle East are foremost in all of our minds. That first use of nuclear weapons, which culminated an unprecedented strategic bombing campaign by the United States, set a new standard for tolerable levels of violence against which all subsequent wars have been fought. The United States has never apologized or even acknowledged the Holocaust that was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And now, more than ever, we have to recognize that there was more than one Holocaust in World War II. What we are facing today, what we have seen emerge fully blown under the Bush administration, is the doctrine of preventive war, actually carried out against Iraq on the pretext, the false pretext, that Iraq had a nuclear weapons program. President Bush told the world that we cannot wait for the smoking gun in the form of a mushroom cloud on the horizon. But what he didn't say was that the mushroom cloud was more likely to come from the United States than from Iraq. In fact, the United States had drawn up contingency plans for battlefield use of nuclear weapons in Iraq, as they have done with Iran. But what many people don't realize, many good people, even many peace activists, is that these policies did not emerge fully blown under the Bush administration. They are the result of a continuum of programs and policies, really, which could be called the national security state, driven by the entrenched military-industrial complex, which began in 1945, or really in 1942 with the Manhattan Project, but in 1945, when President Harry Truman, a Democrat, ordered the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And after World War II, instead of dismantling the Manhattan Project and moving quickly to eliminate nuclear weapons to make sure they could never be used again, instead, the Manhattan Project was institutionalized as the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. And in 1952, the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Laboratory was established in Livermore, California. And there, its charge was to develop a hydrogen bomb orders of magnitude more powerful than the atomic bombs used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The two laboratories, in effect, were told to conduct an arms race with each other, to race to develop a hydrogen bomb. And that internal arms race in the United States has continued until this day. Right now, the Livermore and Los Alamos laboratories are competing with each other to develop an entirely new nuclear warhead under something called the Reliable Replacement Warhead. This would be a warhead to be launched by a ballistic launch submarine. And I'll get back to that. But this internal nuclear arms race has been continuing. Now, let me just go through the litany of the Clinton era, because I think this is very important to understand. When the Cold War ended, I think people in the United States and really around the world breathed a collective sigh of relief, feeling that they had escaped the nuclear holocaust, and they largely put nuclear weapons out of their minds. Again, many good people, many activists went on to other issues. They went on to oppose U.S. wars of intervention in Central America. They worked hard to end apartheid in South Africa. They did all kinds of things. They also, because of the age cohort, got married, had families, got jobs, and so on. And nuclear weapons just dropped off the radar screen. But for those of us who were focused on what was going on at facilities in our neighborhoods, in my case, the Livermore Lab, we saw that very quickly the nuclear weapons establishment regrouped and came up with new justifications to continue with the nuclear weapons enterprise. So as early as 1992, we have Colin Powell, for example, saying we no longer have the luxury of having a specific enemy to plan for. We have to prepare for the possibility that any country could be our enemy. And shortly thereafter, we started seeing the emergence, which was fully developed by Clinton, of the so-called counterproliferation program, which involved making contingency plans to use nuclear weapons to deter the threat or use of not only nuclear weapons, but also chemical or biological weapons against the United States or its allies. And that was a very dangerous policy for many reasons, but one of them is that it equated chemical and biological weapons with nuclear weapons and called them all weapons of mass destruction, which is one of the ways in which the threshold to nuclear weapons use has been lowered. They're not all equal. Nuclear weapons are orders of magnitude more dangerous than chemical or biological weapons, which rightly are called, can be called, should be called weapons of terror. But both chemical and biological weapons are much more difficult to deliver in ways that would kill many thousands of people. For sure, they would terrorize many people. They're awful, horrible, inhumane, illegal weapons. But it's wrong to call them all weapons of mass destruction. In 1994, the Clinton administration issued its first review of U.S. nuclear weapons, its nuclear posture review. And 1994, when we're at peace, when we don't have any enemies, when the Cold War is gone, when Russia is our friend, what do? They rubber stamp business as usual for U.S. nuclear weapons, and they talk about maintaining all of our nuclear capabilities, including a hedge arsenal so that we can rapidly increase the numbers of weapons and capabilities. And this sort of became entrenched in what later became the Stockpile Stewardship Program, again, when the Clinton administration was maneuvered by international developments into signing the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in 1995, or rather in 1994. It was with a very explicit caveat, which in the letter of transmittal to the Senate asking for its ratification, Clinton said, we will maintain all of our nuclear weapons capabilities. We will make a massive reinvestment in the nuclear weapons laboratories to attract and retain the finest human resources. My lab directors will have to certify annually that the weapons are reliable. And so on and so forth. And this program is going to last many years and cost many billions of dollars. Well, today that program, Stockpile Stewardship Program, is costing about $7 billion a year. That's just for research and development of the warheads, modifications of existing warheads, something called the Stockpile Life Extension Plan, which is to extend the lives of our existing nuclear weapons. And now this other thing, which is much more insidious, the Reliable Replacement Warhead Program, which is explicitly intended to replace every warhead in the U.S. arsenal by the year 2030 through something called Complex 2030. That's the name of the new nuclear weapons complex, which is based on the idea of a responsive infrastructure, responsive, flexible infrastructure, so that the United States has the ability to very quickly design nuclear weapons tailored for new kinds of purposes. New military purposes. Again, we shouldn't get too carried away with that either, though, because under Clinton, something called the B-6111 bomb was actually developed and deployed. That was an existing gravity bomb, which was given some earth-penetrating capabilities and has a selectable yield. They actually all do, from a relatively low yield to a relatively high yield, and it is designed to be carried on the B-2 stealth bomber. And its use was covertly threatened against Libya in 1997. That was just a year after Clinton signed Presidential Decision Directive 60, reaffirming the threatened first use of nuclear weapons as the cornerstone of U.S. national security policy. And then, of course, it was Clinton who signed legislation making it national policy to deploy a national missile defense system as soon as it was technologically feasible, Then Bush came in, walked out of the ABM treaty, and off we go. So what I'm trying to say, to show you here, is that we have a continuum, and that just getting rid of the Bush administration, just getting a Democrat in the White House, I'm sorry to say, especially if it's a Democrat who's closely associated with the former president, is not going to address this problem in any meaningful way. Now, let me talk a little bit about missiles. Let me talk a little bit about what happened in the 1990s when people forgot about nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons generally became relegated increasingly to a very small policy elite circle in Washington, D.C., who were concerned with arms control rather than elimination of nuclear weapons. And their focus got narrower and narrower and narrower. And I'm sorry to say that that approach was very much supported by most of the funders, the funding community. And so independent groups like ours, who are not focused on Washington, D.C., who have been important pipelines for information about what's really going on, have been really marginalized and struggling for survival, while those who've been well-funded have focused only on the United States from a very D.C.-centric way. They have focused very narrowly on warheads and even more narrowly on particular weapons systems. They haven't talked about delivery systems at all, and they're not necessarily anti-war when you come right down to it. In the last couple of years, you may have been aware of a campaign against the so-called robust nuclear earth penetrator, which was a nuclear weapon under design, a very high-yield nuclear weapon designed to burrow deeply into the earth before exploding. Well, the funds for that were cut mostly over the last 2 years, but while people were declaring victory, the overall nuclear weapons budget increased substantially more than that cut would have accounted for. And now we have this reliable replacement warhead program, where we have just learned that they're probably working on 4 new warheads instead of just 2. And the part that almost nobody's talking about, again, is the delivery systems, which I do want to talk a little bit about because it's important. A nuclear warhead is a relatively harmless, worthless thing if it's just sitting here. There could be one sitting right here on the stage next to us, and without a delivery system, it wouldn't be much of a weapon. But the United States is now, the Pentagon is involved in proposed new strategic delivery systems, ranging from new long-range bombers and intercontinental ballistic missiles to reusable launch vehicles. And this is with the explicit intent of something called a prompt global strike capability, where the U.S. wants to be able to hit any target on Earth within 30 minutes or less with any kind of a warhead, be it nuclear or conventional. Now, let me talk briefly about the North Korean missile. Before the conflagration in the Middle East took over the news, we were hearing a lot about this supposed tremendous threat from North Korea because it was getting ready to launch a long-range missile. That missile launch took place around the end of June. Did you know that on June 14th, the United States successfully test-launched a Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missile from Vandenberg Air Force Base on the central coast of California? Then it launched another one on July 20th. These were carrying 3 dummy warheads. They went 4,200 miles to Kwajalein Atoll in less than 30 minutes and successfully delivered all of their targets. There have been 23 of these tests from Vandenberg just since January of 2000. The Minuteman III happens to be actively deployed in Montana, North Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado, and Nebraska. There are 500 of them actively deployed there. Each one carries a single warhead with a yield either 10 or 20 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. So who is threatening whom? More shocking than the fact that these tests are going on and the Americans are unaware of it, although I assure you the North Koreans are not unaware of it, a few days before the North Korean test, an op-ed appeared in the Washington Post by William Perry, who was Clinton's Secretary of Defense, and Ashton Carter, his undersecretary. and they were calling upon the U.S. to preemptively destroy the North Korean missile, even at the risk of igniting a regional war. These same two individuals, under the Clinton administration, had drawn up a very similar plan in 1993, which was almost carried out. Clinton was, in fact, very close to preemptively destroying North Korea's nuclear reactors in 1993, and was talked out of it by the South Korean Prime Minister. So again, this policy of preemptive strike can be traced back, in part, to the Clinton administration. Let me talk a little bit about Iran, which is a very serious situation now. Seymour Hersh documented in The New Yorker that there were, in fact, active planning. There was, in fact, active planning underway in the Pentagon for the potential use of U.S. nuclear weapons against Iran's underground facilities. He subsequently reported that there were people high up in the military who were so alarmed about this that they were threatening to resign. And in a later story, says that the option was taken off the table, at least for the time being, which should not reassure us too much, because these options can be put on and taken off the table rather easily. It appears that the United States and Israel have drawn a line in the sand with Iran, where they have decided that they're not going to allow Iran to attain the capability to enrich uranium for its civilian nuclear power program, even though Iran has a right to do so under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and even though Iran, the International Atomic Energy Agency, has found no evidence of an Iranian nuclear weapons program or of any diversion of materials for nuclear weapons. And I think it's useful to read out a list of other countries that have uranium enrichment capability and realize how selectively we are being forced to look at Iran. Canada, Argentina, Brazil, France, the Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, Britain, Russia, China, India, Japan, Australia, and Kazakhstan. All of those countries have sophisticated uranium enrichment capabilities, but you don't hear us threatening to use nuclear weapons against them. So, we are often called, people who are calling for the global abolition of nuclear weapons, starting with our own here, are often accused of being unrealistic. We are called idealists and so on. But I want to close by making the case that we are extremely realistic. The only practical way to prevent the use of a nuclear weapon is to get rid of nuclear weapons. And we now have the backing from a rather establishment source. Hans Blix, who was the head of the inspection teams in Iraq, who did not find any weapons of mass destruction there, headed a commission, an independent commission established by the Swedish government called the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, and they put out their report, Weapons of Terror, Freeing the World of Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Arms, on June 1st. And listen to this practical advice. So long as any state has nuclear weapons, others will want them. So long as any such weapons remain, there is a risk they will one day be used by design or accident, and any such use would be catastrophic. The Commission rejects the suggestion that nuclear weapons in the hands of some pose no threat, while in the hands of others they place the world in mortal jeopardy. Governments possessing nuclear weapons can act responsibly or recklessly. Governments may also change over time. 27,000 nuclear weapons are not an abstract theory. They exist in today's world. The Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, each of which had an explosive yield of less than 20 kilotons of TNT, killed some 200,000 people. The W-76, the standard nuclear warhead used on U.S. Trident submarine-launched ballistic missiles, has a yield of up to 100 kilotons. And this is the core. The question of how to reduce the threat and number of existing nuclear weapons must be addressed with no less vigor than the question of the threat from additional weapons, whether in the hands of existing nuclear weapon states, proliferating states, or terrorists. Explanations by the nuclear haves that the weapons are indispensable to defend their sovereignty are not the best way to convince other sovereign states to renounce the option. Very practical advice from the Blix Commission. So I'll end now, and so that I have a few minutes to take some questions, and maybe somebody wants to ask me about what's been happening activist-wise, since I didn't get to that. Thank you. Sure. I think the question of depleted uraniums is a serious question that deserves attention. Depleted uranium sounds like it's not radioactive, but that's not true. It's a waste product, essentially, from uranium enrichment. And it is an alpha emitter, like plutonium, which means that when it is vaporized into particles and ingested or breathed, it can sit into the body and it can sit there and irradiate and cause cancers over time. And it's used for armor-piercing bullets. It's used to make very hard, heavy armor for tanks and things like that. It also is believed to have very serious chemical toxic characteristics, which may be the source of some of the diseases that we're seeing now because of the long latency periods having to do with radiation. But I really am not comfortable calling depleted uranium a nuclear weapon because the heat and blast are so extreme and the amount of devastation that is possible within just a few minutes is so extreme in the case of a nuclear weapon that I really think we need to think of them separately, and we need to think of getting rid of those weapons. And that goes again to the need to end war, because I've actually heard advocates of abolishing depleted uranium say, well, we could use tungsten instead, and I think that misses the point. So I think that we definitely should be advocating very strenuously to stop using depleted uranium in weapons, but I would like to say, let's just get rid of the weapons. Let's stop making those kinds of weapons. Just like I'd like to say, I am saying, let's get rid of nuclear weapons and not replace them with conventional weapons, which is the other thing that this kind of circular logic leads to in the arms control community. We don't need nuclear bunker busters because we have conventional ones. That's not a good answer for me.
Right. We're the ones that should be disarming. Right.
Well, I think that was the central point of the Blix Commission that I was reading, but I'll just close this session by saying that if the most powerful military force that has ever existed in the history of the planet, namely the United States, reserves for itself and insists that it needs to rely on the threatened first use of nuclear weapons to ensure its national security, then we should not be surprised to see other countries follow suit. And as long as the United States spends more money on its military than every other country in the world, then we also should not be surprised, combined, then we also should not be surprised if some other countries feel the need to seek nuclear weapons because they can't compete with the conventional military superiority of the United States, which is another way in which all of these kinds of weaponry are bound up together. That's why I would say it is time for a global ceasefire, and it's time to abolish nuclear weapons, starting with our own. And as Americans, it's up to us. Nobody else is going to do it for us. So thank you very much.